Chapter 20. Storm Armada. "We have a problem," Alustin said, dumping out a huge load of assorted paper scraps from his satchel onto the patch of decking that he'd just dried off with a cantrip. Hugh knew that his teacher had dumped all those paper scraps into his satchel from his arm tattoo, but there were clear and obvious advantages to people not knowing where you were actually storing things. The paper scraps abruptly formed themselves into a moving paper sea, with tiny swells and a miniature model of the rising cormorant in the centre. "The second storm is, like we expected, going to miss us by leagues. Unfortunately, I scried at least a half dozen more already on their way, and even more forming in the edges of the Skyreach range. I think we can all agree they're unnatural, but there's nothing we can do to stop them. This is clearly the work of one or more of the great powers," Alustin said. Stylized storm clouds rose up from the little paper sea behind the model of the cormorant. Most of the group stole glances at Sabé, though Hugh found his sliding over to her side, where Talia was standing. Their eyes locked, and to Hugh's surprise, Talia looked away first, blushing. "We're well ahead of schedule, thanks to the boost the first storm gave us," Alustin said. "But getting to the second or third potential locations for Imperial Ithos's return is going to be a problem." The Radahn all got confused looks for a second, then Captain Greffa shook her head. "This would all be so much easier if you could tell us what you're looking for," she said. "Unfortunately, I can't," Alustin said. "The Thermesari Harbour is impassable during storm surges. Its gravity enchantments can keep the water in bowl shape under normal conditions, but they're overwhelmed during storms," Alustin said. "Even if we made it in, we've got at least a week's march overland to get to the site, and it's a middling quality one on a ridge that stretches out from the Skyreach foothills into the jungle. Then we'd have no way to get out, and the cormorant would be trapped in the holding pools atop the cliffs until the storms ended, and we don't know when that would be." Arta leaned over to Hugh at his confused look.
"The gravity enchantments in Thermesari pulls the water and ships sailing in it against the cliffs so that the ships can just sail straight up the side, then over to the holding pools. It's a sight to see. Not a particularly large city, but I reckon a lot of ships just added to their routes for the view."
Alustin nodded at that, and a tiny seaside city atop a line of cliffs formed, the paper sea crawling up its cliffs unnaturally. "The third site," Alustin continued, "is in an open patch of ocean to the southeast of Thermesari." A mark formed on the paper model of the sea.
"Wait, why would Imperial Ithos be out in the ocean?" Hugh asked.
Several of the nearby Radahn shook their heads, confused. "It probably wasn't," Alustin said. "Odds are it's none of the sites we'll be checking. This one is an especially low probability. Successful floating cities are exceptionally rare, and they seldom survive more than a couple generations. The tides and storms are simply too much for them, no matter how well built or designed. It's also dead centre in the path of at least four or five storms."
"So are you thinking Site 4 or Site 5 then?" Godric asked.
Talia started to perk up at that, and Hugh could see Sabé visibly rolling her eyes. Hugh recalled Talia's guess that it would be the last site they checked.
"Site 4, Alustin said. "Zophor is closer than Nidassus, and it's one of the highest priority sites being investigated."
Talia deflated.
"Hold on," Sabé said. "Isn't Zophor both in a swamp and in a fairly high ether density region?"
Alustin shrugged.
"It's a tidal delta, which is a fairly specific type of swamp. But yes, it has fairly high density ether. It also has a junction manor well with a complex labyrinth. The actual site in question is Lake Nilo, about a week's travel upriver from Zophor. It's a huge, shallow lake that the Elosa River passes through on its way to the Delta and Zophor. The paper scraps swarmed and twisted, and the sea was replaced by a map of the shore, showing a great river delta, with a sort of crude grid of channels formed by the tide overwhelming the river's current twice a day. The islands were completely covered in a shockingly detailed rainforest. As Hugh traced the paper river upwards, it slowly grew more and more dominated by the river current, until it was a vast interlocking braid of rivers, filled with great islands. Hugh seldom saw anything like a distant bank to the river on a paper map. Instead, the water seemed to intrude into the forest, and the trees of the forest into the river. In fact, many, if not most of the islands in the channel, on second glance, were more groves of trees protruding from the paper waters than anything. Hugh didn't know how accurate Alustin's paper map was, but...
"Hold on a second," he asked, not looking up. "Where's Zophor? I don't see a city on here."
A bit of a laugh went around the deck.
"It's definitely there, Stormward," Captain Greffer said. "You'll understand when we get there."
Hugh glanced up, confused. Even Godric and Sabbe seemed a little amused at the question. Only Talia also seemed confused. Then she froze and looked up towards Alustin with a smile.
"Wait, is it like Hold Your Howl?" Talia asked.
Alustin nodded.
"Even more impressive in some ways," he said.
"Hold Your Howl?" Hugh asked.
"The closest thing to a capital city the clans have," Arta said. "Beautiful place."
"We don't have a capital," Talia said, glaring at Arta. "It's just the biggest clan hold, is all."
"I'm not sure hold quite does Yehal justice," Arta said. "It's a full city on its own."
Elustin raised his hand to quiet them, and the paper delta collapsed into scraps on the deck.
"One important difference between Hold Your Howl and Zophor is that Zophor is the domain of the Lich Zophor. He created it wholesale a little over a century ago," Elustin said.
"Humble sort, sounds like, to name a whole city after himself," Talia muttered.
"Zophor is one of the most powerful liches on the continent," Elustin said. "He's no ally to either Kandaron nor the Havath Dominion. We need to be careful not to offend him while we're there."
Waves began to form slowly in the piles of paper scraps. Then the rising cormorant seemed to rise out of the waves. Off to one side of the map formed a clear representation of the Ithonian coastline, with paper sky retrained foothills to the west and the Elosa River delta to the east.
"Here's the problem," Alustin said. "Or problems, I suppose. First, the storms."
Stylized storms rose all throughout the paper map. Hugh glanced behind him, where he could see the second storm near the horizon, while off to one side, he thought he could see yet another storm forming.
"Even assuming they were our only problem, we'd likely have to pass through at least five more of those storms before we got to Zophor," Alustin said. "We could try and avoid them, but that would add days, if not a full week, onto our trip. And given how quickly the Exile Splinter's hold on Imperial Ithos is fading, we don't know how long it will be until the city merges back into our world."
The Rathan all looked confused to the point of pain, and several of them were clutching their heads now. Alustin's face turned grave, and the Skyhold party exchanged worried looks. The Rathan's confusion grew worse and lasted longer every time the city was mentioned. It had taken a year and a half of Alustin mentioning it regularly for the Exile Splinter's hold on Hugh and his friends to collapse, but it appeared to be progressing far more swiftly for the Rathan. Hugh couldn't help but notice Sabbe was practically glaring at Alustin. Hugh was used to others keeping secrets from him. In all honesty, he rather liked being ignorant of the dangerous political currents that often moved around him. But Sabbe and Alustin definitely knew something that they hadn't told the others, and it had been splitting the two of them steadily apart since the aftermath of Midsummer.
Hugh might not be the most observant person ever, but this was hard to ignore. Finally, after what had to be almost a full minute, the Radhan all seemed to refocus. The other Radhan sailors on deck, cleaning up the damage from the storm, didn't seem to have even noticed their confusion.
"The storms aren't our only problem, though," Alustin said. "Then we have the sea serpents. We could normally handle that one well enough, save for the fact that the ship's water mages are already exhausted from just a single storm. And keeping watch for sea serpents while dodging or crossing storms would be a nightmare."
"What do you want to bet the storms are behind the serpents stirring?"
Arta said. No one took him up on that bet.
"So, then we've got our third problem," Alustin said.
More ships began to assemble on the paper sea, forming out of clouds of scraps, not rising whole from the waves.
"Havarthi privateers," Alustin said. "They might not have a navy worth a pair of old socks, but they've got the money to hire as many independent ships as they could ever want. I've found at least a dozen so far, all with complements of sacred swordsmen and assorted battle mages on board. And there might be more caught in the storms as well. They even have a war ammonite in the area. It looks like they're actively hunting for us. They don't appear to be heading to Zophor, so I suspect they don't know about that site yet, though they do seem aware of Nidassus, the Meseri, and the third site."
There was a moment of silence, then quite a few moments of cursing from nearly everyone.
"How exactly are you proposing we get through storms, sea serpents, and ships hunting us?"
Arta said.
"Fairly easily," Alustin said, smirking. "There's a reason I picked this ship, after all. Same reason it's called the Rising Cormorant. It should also let us safely check sites 3 and 4.
All the Radhan went still and silent, and finally Captain Greffa sighed.
"Of course you know about that. It won't work, though. It's a short-term solution. It won't work across these sorts of ranges. There's no way we can supply that much mana to the enchantments for that long."
Alustin's smirk grew even wider.
"No, but Sabi and Hugh can handle that."
Hugh shifted uncomfortably as all eyes turned to the two of them. Despite the cryptic pronouncements, Alustin didn't tell them what he'd been talking about. Instead, he, Captain Greffa, and some of the ship's officers spent several hours arguing and debating. Whatever Alustin's plan was, it wouldn't be starting until the next morning. And he gave them all training to work on in the meantime, at that. Talia was assigned a series of exercises meant to help her cast increasingly small dream bolts, using minuscule amounts of mana. Alustin had been somewhat irritated when he'd found out how she'd killed a Bilasutus atop Skyhold. He was happy she'd saved the others, but Talia had received a long, pointed lecture about the difference between siege magic and battle magic. Siege magic, especially artillery magic, focused on expending the entirety of a mage's mana reservoir on a single spell, meant to punch through powerful defences. Depending on the ether density around them, they could often only cast a single spell per hour. Even mediocre artillery mages could fire archmage-level spells, and powerful siege mages were a serious danger even to great powers. The problem was that once a mana reservoir was trained to do siege magic, it became almost unusable for other magic. The change was irreparable as well. Siege mages were simply only useful as part of an army, not as independent operatives. And while the vast majority of battle mages Skyhold trained were destined to serve in armies across the continent, save, apparently, for in the Havarth Dominion and a few unfriendly city-states, Alustin was most certainly not putting in the time for something so mundane. Even most army mages weren't trained in siege magic. It was a very limited duty. And if Talia kept using monstrous attack spells like the one she'd used against Abyla, ones that simply used all mana she had available in her mana reservoir, it could start happening to her. It wouldn't happen immediately, or even quickly. But Alustin knew quite a few mages who had slowly degraded their abilities to use more delicate magic over time. Apparently, Headmaster Tarik's obsession with mana efficiency wasn't just for the purposes of making her already absurd mana reservoir stretch even farther, but was also to help her retain her ability to do fine work with her magic. There wasn't a set size where magic started counting as siege magic, however. Instead, it had to do with the size of the spell related to the size of the caster's mana reservoir, and to how precise the mana requirements for the spell were. So Talia had to sit there for hours on end, manifesting and holding swarms of tiny, fingernail-sized dream bolts in front of her, gradually progressing to smaller sizes and larger swarms. To everyone's surprise, Talia hadn't complained in the slightest, but had taken Alustin very seriously.
"It might make me more powerful," Talia had said, "but it also leaves me less capable of defending myself or others. What use is more power if it leaves you less battle-ready?"
Sabe, meanwhile, was progressing in using wind and water armor at the same time. Rather than just holding one on each arm, Alustin had her passing segments of each around her body. The ship's sailors had been instructed to call out commands to her whenever they passed. Move the spinning water to her left arm, or the wind to her right leg. They quickly jumped into the spirit of the training, giving her contradictory commands, elaborate patterns to follow, or making her move the two spinning sections of armor in time to the beat of sea shanties. They didn't come close to her, though. The armor had a nasty habit of exploding off her when the wind and water passed over or even too close to each other when she wasn't focusing, and it could easily knock a person down. It definitely knocked Sabe down quite a bit. Hugh spotted her surreptitiously healing her own bruises every now and then. Hugh and Godric had been assigned training together, under Arta. Specifically, working with what had once been a sword made of ice, and was now a ring of ice. Godric stared at both of them in slight horror as they showed him what they'd turned the weapon into.
"Neither of ye are enchanters," Godric said. "Couldn't ye have sunk the ship, altering an enchanted weapon like that?"
"We didn't make a single change to the enchantment, son," Arta said. "It was never a sword at all."
"It was always a ring," Hugh said. "The swordsman had just persuaded it to form a sword-shaped shell around itself." "It's alive?" Godric asked. "I'm supposed to wear a living ring that might still be loyal to Havas."
Hugh shook his head.
"It's not like my book. I'm pretty sure your average snail is considerably smarter than it is. Most of our work was just persuading it to change its shape."
"Hugh's spellbook is something special," Arta said. "I've never heard about an item packed by a warlock getting that smart that fast. Reckon it might have to do with the way the labyrinth stone is part of Hugh's pact with Kandaron, not to mention merged into Hugh's attuned ether crystal. Plus, I don't know anyone who really understands labyrinth stones. They don't work by Anastan spellform rules, growing in labyrinths as they do. Anyhow, an enchanted weapon would have to be bonded to a person for years and years before it gets that smart. Some of the older ones, like Grovebringer, are nearly as smart as people."
A thought occurred to Hugh, and he looked around with a little alarm. He hadn't seen his spellbook since just after the storm ended. It had stayed slung around his shoulder for the whole storm. For all its mischievousness, it seemed to understand exactly when there was danger, and it needed to behave. He would bet money that it was up to something right now.
"Regardless, I couldn't have done this without you," Arta said. "I doubt anyone but a warlock could talk to this little lass with any ease. I'll be right back."
Arta got up and walked off. Godric stared uncertainly at the ring in his palm.
"Is this ring really female?" he asked. Hugh shook his head. It barely even has self-awareness or a personality.
I think your dad just likes assigning personalities to things.
Godric snorted at that.
Ha! You're not wrong there. I can't tell you how many times I've caught him being disappointed at a cooking pot, like it burnt the food to spite him.
Arta returned carrying a pair of water barrels, one under each arm. So far as Hugh could tell, he wasn't even using any spells to lighten them. Even ignoring how powerful a mage Arta was, he was kind of terrifying. They were smaller barrels, but each of them had to weigh considerably more than Hugh did. Arta set both down with a loud thud, then the nails simply flew out of the lid of one barrel. He snagged them out of the air and shoved them into one of his pockets before removing the lid.
"Toss her in," Arta said.
Godric looked askance at him, then shrugged and tossed the ring in the water. It sunk briefly, then bobbed immediately back to the surface. There was a loud crackling noise and the ring began to grow, but not out across the surface of the water as ice normally would. The centre of the ring filled in, then expanded vertically. The water level in the barrel began to visibly drop as a shaft of ice began to rise from the water. Within 5 heartbeats, it had finished growing, the water level far below where it had started. The spell-form engraved shaft of ice rose up out of the water, bobbing faintly. The only reason it didn't fall out of the barrel was that the tilt of the shaft was holding the bottom against the inside of the barrel.
"You're going to pull it out? Or just look at it?"
Arta asked Godric with a smile. Another detonation came from Sabi's direction, but they only spared her a glance as she picked herself up from the deck, dripping wet. Godric reached out and touched the shaft.
"It's not as cold as I was expecting," he said. "Still cold, but not painful to hold."
"One of the enchantments on it," Arta said. "Go on, then."
Godric closed his fingers around it, then pulled it out of the barrel, revealing a massive hammerhead. As the water coursed off the ice, Godric spun it, showing off the icicle-shaped spike coming from the back.
"This is way bigger than any hammer I've wielded before," Godric said. "Lighter, though."
"Ice doesn't weigh as much as iron," Hugh said.
Godric and Arta gave him almost identical looks with raised eyebrows.
"Right," Hugh said. "Sorry. Bit obvious."
"I named her Hailstrike," Arta said. "And he and you are going to be spending a lot of time training with ice over the next few days. There isn't any naturally occurring stone in the Elosa River Delta, which is a big disadvantage for both of you. And ice isn't near as easy to use as normal stone is."
"What about you, sir?" Hugh asked.
Arta sighed.
"You call me sir again, and I'll throw you in the ocean. You're a great friend to me, son. You've saved his life on multiple occasions, and you're pleasant company. As far as I'm concerned, you're the next thing to family. So call me by my name."
"Yes, sir. I mean, Arta," Hugh said, a little uncomfortable.
He couldn't help but smile, though.
"But won't you be at the same disadvantage in the Delta without stone?"
Arta chuckled.
"Don't ye worry about me, Hugh. I am never at a disadvantage."
As he eyed the stone mage's broad smile, Hugh was really, really glad Arta was on his side. They all turned at the sound of Talia yelling and cursing. She appeared to be covered in live panicking eels, and Hugh's spellbook was hovering excitedly nearby. Hugh sighed.
"I really don't think my spellbook understands how apologies or apology gifts work."